Good afternoon. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I will ask the marshal to call us in.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bradfold, Judge Gorkman, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Diane B. Bradfold presiding. Now calling Vicki Jones versus Michael Dan Smilinich.
And so our case, which is second on our calendar today, has been called, and I'll make just a few quick reminders to counsel before we proceed with arguments. First of all, I want you to understand that we do appreciate that this is a cross appeal, and so that both sides do have issues that they have obviously briefed to the court that we've had a chance to read, but we nonetheless are proceeding with our usual oral argument format. And I know that you're both experienced and have been here before and are familiar with our rules. Our rules really continue to be the same, even though we are hearing argument in a slightly different format. And so we ask you to follow them. If you have any questions, of course, ask that as well, and we're ready to respond. And then before you start your remarks, please identify yourself for the record as well as the client you represent. So the arguments today are being recorded and they are preserved and made available on our website as well as for use by the court if we need them later. So with that, I think we're ready for counsel for appellant, and we're starting with appellant doctors. Now, I will probably make a mistake in pronunciations, but
Smilinich.
So Dr. Smilinich is the first to begin with arguments. So please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning or good afternoon. Kate McBride here on behalf of the Smilinich defendants, the appellants, as well as Twin Cities Dental Center. This court's precedent and that from the Minnesota Supreme Court answer the primary and dispositive issue here today. And that is whether, as a matter of law, the fraud verdict is contrary to law and therefore cannot stand. It cannot stand because the alleged fraud here arose from the therapeutic relationship between Dr. Smilinich and Ms. Jones, and therefore needed to be brought as some type of medical malpractice claim. The DAB case from this court dictates the result here. There, the physician at issue failed to disclose a kickback scheme to his patients. This court said that the failure to disclose material facts related to treatment and was a breach of his duty as a physician. Quote, the court said, a patient deserves a treatment plan unsullied by conflicting motives and free from self-serving considerations. And any breach of that duty that arises while the doctor is examining, diagnosing, treating, or caring for a patient is conduct that flows from the therapeutic relationship and therefore must be framed as a medical malpractice claim. And then that case was dismissed as a matter of law. Here,
let me ask you this. I mean, I'm familiar with the DAB case. You know, it strikes me that this is not a classic, you know, negligent non-disclosure case because, you know, it wasn't a failure to disclose the risks or benefits of a particular course of treatment. And that's sort of the classic situation. What is it about the claimed misrepresentations here that you still say is so close to the nature of the therapeutic relationship that it becomes part of the malpractice claim?
Sure. Well, here, the claim is that Dr. Smilinich failed to disclose that he was having financial issues that would have impacted future care. It was communicated while she was in a dental chair in his dental office discussing whether to go forward with treatment. And Dr. Smilinich knew that this was information to which she would attach significance. And that's what you need to disclose as your duty and which gives rise to a negligent non-disclosure. She needed this information to decide whether to go forward with dental treatment. And therefore it occurred during the therapeutic relationship. Indeed, plaintiff himself, herself in her brief states, the lies were made to fraudulently induce Jones to continue her dental care. And indeed also, we may need to remember that their expert framed Dr. Smilinich's duty to tell her the answer to her question truthfully as a standard of care as a dentist. I would point you to...
Ms. McBride, I want to follow up because before you get too far, maybe you can explain for us what the kickback scheme was in DAB.
They were getting money for drugs that they were prescribing. That's my understanding.
The self-serving statement financially was that the doctor is prescribing a particular medication and then receiving money from the company to prescribe that medication. Do you make any distinction between the connection there to treatment, right? The treatment is prescribing medication. The kickback is getting money for prescribing medication. Do you make any distinction between the connection in DAB between the financial self-serving representation and, or the financial self-serving statement and the treatment? Do you make any distinction between that and what's happening here, where it seems that the statements that are made relate to the ongoing commercial stability or viability of the practice generally, and not to, for example, receiving a kickback for, you know, using a particular kind of temporary bridge or a particular kind of treatment. This is a statement about the general financial stability. Do you make any distinction at all?
I do not, Your Honor, because it is still information that the standard for what a physician, a dentist, a medical provider needs to disclose is information to which the patient would attach significance. And so, yes, it was different in DAB, but let's look at Paulo's case. Let's look at that case. There, the doctor was asked, are you board certified? And he lied about that. And that was information he knew that the patient would attach significance to. The patient wanted to know for purposes of going forward. Here, the information that the patient wanted to know for purposes of whether she should continue her treatment was whether he was going to be able to provide that very treatment or whether he was in such financial shape that there would be little to no possibility that she could go forward or a significant delay. So it was intricately connected to and arose out of the care and treatment of this patient. It was information she needed to know. And I would like to point out importantly that DAB rejected the attempt to create a new cause of action. They specifically said, we will not create a cause of action, a breach of fiduciary duty on the part of a dentist. There is no separate duty. Any duty that the provider has to his patient to talk truthfully about information that impacts the decision on treatment arises out of medical malpractice. And we will not allow for a new cause of action. Allowing a new cause of action, this court said, would permit avoidance of every statute defining the patient-physician relationship. Here, that failure arose out of, it was part and parcel of whether she should actually go forward with this treatment that she wanted to seek or whether it was never going to happen or whether it would be delayed.
Didn't you argue in your brief that had this been, for example, had Dr. Smilinich enlisted Jones in a pyramid scheme, then, quote, Jones could most certainly bring an action for fraud. So isn't that inconsistent with how you're asking us to look at DAB, where you're saying that they explicitly reject creating a cause of action because your brief seems to suggest that there would be a cause of action?
Absolutely not. And let me be clear. Let me clarify, since obviously I was not. If Dr. Smilinich, as a dentist, tried to get a patient to invest in some real estate scheme that he had cooked up, it would have had nothing to do with her treatment. It would have had nothing to do with whether she should go forward and pay him this money so that he could perform this dental service. If he was involved in some kind of Petters-like Ponzi scheme or whatever, something completely disconnected. It's not that dentist as a person or any physician can't be sued for fraud, but they cannot be sued for fraud, they cannot be sued for some cause of action other than malpractice, when the complained of conduct is relates to and arises out of the therapeutic relationship. And here it most certainly did, because it was absolutely, as she said, as they said, it was absolutely critical to her to have this information so that she would know whether to go forward with her dental treatment. It was whether he was going to actually even be able to do that. So it was intricately connected and not some separate, you know, I've got a bridge to sell you kind of thing. It's not about his employment. It's not about his occupation. It's about the context within which this arose.
Difference between a regular bridge and a dental bridge.
Right. You don't need a license to lie, but the providers in DAB and Paulos, et cetera, the issue there was that they failed to disclose information that the patient wanted and needed. In Kaiser, the Supreme Court said, if you're looking at performing functions for which a professional license is required, and of course, here Dr. Smilinich needed a license to provide this dental care. And when in providing that, he owed his patients a duty to tell them all the information that they would need. What the jury did, it was not a question of whether the jury could find fraud, but whether it should have been allowed to in the first place. And this is an issue of law for the court, just as it was.
So, counsel, I'm trying to understand, and I don't mean to interrupt you because I know you're talking about the case, but I'm trying to understand what the impact would have been if the district court would have dismissed the fraud count. It just, you're suggesting that the evidence would have still been relevant and gone to the jury as to the doctor's representations that were made to Ms. Jones, but what, the damages would have been different?
If the court had dismissed the fraud claim, they would have proceeded with the only other pled claim, and that is negligent treatment. Certainly.
You're saying that this is part of the negligent treatment claim, right?
No. There are many different kinds of medical malpractice claims. One of them is negligent treatment, which the jury rejected. The other would be negligent non-disclosure. And as I stated in my reply brief, and now the case, sorry, is escaping me, there were several examples of cases that have gone forward with both a negligent treatment and a negligent non-disclosure. They're not mutually exclusive.
So you're saying that without having pled negligent non-disclosure, none of this would have gone to the jury at all? Not, when I say none of this, I mean none of the financial misrepresentation. I mean, the jury found they were misrepresentations, so I think it's fair to say none of that would have gone to the jury. Is that right?
I don't think that he would have been able to do that. No. He was pleading negligent treatment, which he was certainly able to do, and she was able to do, and went forward. But to plead these claims, you needed to plead them in a certain way, and he did not. And the reasons that he misled her are irrelevant, because the fact that he was having personal or financial difficulties, it's that he didn't disclose the information that she needed. In the 3 minutes I have left, I'll briefly turn to, even if this court didn't prohibit, decided that the law does not prohibit the fraud claim, and obviously we believe it does, plaintiff here failed to establish that she sustained any legally cognizable fraud damages. And this too is an issue of law for the court on judgment as a matter of law. Here, the law only permits out-of-pocket losses. Here, what did the plaintiff do?
I think that out-of-pocket loss is a general rule, but there's exceptions would exist in cases where there is economic loss. I mean, there have been exceptions recognized. What evidence of economic loss was presented here?
There was no evidence of economic loss other than the $8,000. She didn't incur any job loss, or there was no evidence of any other kind of economic loss here whatsoever, except that the $8,000 that she gave them on that March 13th date. But here, of course, the jury found that work, that the dental bridge, met the standard of care. So she got what she paid for in terms of she paid $8,000 for it and she got it because it was a bridge that met the standard of care. But the district court
got it later than she had. I mean, there's no delay kind of damage that's available in this kind of case.
I think they could have certainly pled a negligent delay of treatment claim. Again, if you're going to stick with fraud, then you're stuck with the damages that you're allowed to get. The district court said, she could have recovered them if she had been successful in asserting a negligent non-disclosure claim. So no harm, no foul. But that's not how the law works. You actually have to assert and prove, and they would have had to prove the elements of a negligent non-disclosure claim or a negligent delay of treatment claim and prove that up in order to get these damages. But these damages, fraud doesn't cause bone loss. Fraud doesn't cause inability to chew or TMJ pain. And that's the problem. If you're going to stick with fraud, then you're stuck with those damages. Here, there was no evidentiary basis for the idea that she sustained any economic loss whatsoever because she got the bridge that she paid for, and there was no other evidence of any economic loss. But you don't even need to get to that issue because the first issue is dispositive. I respectfully request that this court follow existing precedent, find that this was a discussion that arose out of therapeutic relationship, and enter JMOL in favor of the Smilich defendants. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. So counsel for respondent, we're ready for you to begin when you're ready.
Okay, thank you. I'm Mark Onstead, and I represent Vicki Jones. I'm here to answer your questions. I'm happy that you've read our briefs. I'll try not to repeat them. If I have time, I'm going to address three issues, but feel free to interject as I know you do. The first issue that's big in the case is whether the jury verdict should remain or should it be set aside. The law is that a jury verdict must be sustained if there's any basis for it. The defense argues that the verdict cannot stand because there was expert testimony that lying is malpractice. But jurors are free to ignore expert testimony if they want to. And there are cases.
I think in fairness, Mr. Onstead, I think the argument goes beyond that. I think what the appellants are asserting here is that the law does not permit a malpractice-based, or it does not permit a separate fraud case under the facts that are present in this case. Not so much what the expert testimony is, but just the nature of this claim sounds in malpractice as a matter of law. How do you respond to that argument?
Yeah, I think they made both arguments, but the second one is more emphasized. I have several answers to that. One is it's too late. They should have brought this up before it went to the jury. They did not move for a new trial. So the only issues are there facts supporting the conclusions, and does the law support the ultimate judgment? We had a charging conference. They never brought this up and said, well, you can't have the jury decide this fraud claim because it's really a malpractice claim. They didn't do that. And there's case law that says if you let the instructions go and the verdict go, you're stuck with it. Secondly, this is not a failure to give proper instructions about the risks of the procedure. I thought about pleading this as that type of professional malpractice, but then I looked at the jury instructions, and 80.25 says it's a failure to disclose the risks of the procedure or the treatment. And the standard jury verdict question 80.92 asks if the healthcare professional failed to disclose the risks of the quote specific procedure, operation, or treatment. And this was not a risk of any of those specific treatments. So it just doesn't fit into that box. The jury
So, counsel, if you wouldn't mind for a moment comparing this to the facts that we have in, is it the Paulson case? I'm probably saying that wrong. But the other case where the fraudulent representation Paulus case was whether the physician was board certified or not, and that led a patient to decide, you know, to proceed with treatment. This court rejected misrepresentation. So how is this different? Because we also have here Dr. Smilinich making representations that then lead Ms. Jones to proceed with treatment, give him $8,000. And we all know the rest of the story, which was, you know, obviously had a bad outcome from her perspective as the jury believed with regard to the damages that the jury awarded her. So how do we compare those two cases?
I think the difference is in the Paulos case, the lack of board certification dealt with the actual care and treatment of the patient. In this case, the misrepresentations had to do with his marital life, his debts, his health.
Whether he would lose his practice. So, I mean, if you lose your practice, you're not really in a position to continue providing medical care.
You are, well, I think that goes too far because then almost everything would be something that would have to be pled out as malpractice.
And I think Ms. McBride would agree with that.
You think what? Oh, Ms. McBride would agree with that. Well, those other cases also dealt with, you know, statute of limitations or not having an expert. But you still have to look at the language. And the language, I think the Paulos case is the closest case to this one. I think the kickback on the pills clearly had to do with the nature of the treatment. But his practice here, he wasn't losing his practice. He still has his license. And in fact, he did end up practicing elsewhere. What he lost was his physical facilities. Even had the same staff when he moved to Hopkins.
Can I ask a question about when you say it's too late because there wasn't a motion for new trial and instead it was a post-trial motion for judgment as a matter of law? This gets to the cross appeal as well. Because as I understand it, the pleading that was made regarding including TCDC in the judgment, that wasn't a new trial motion either. That wasn't a motion for judgment as a matter of law. There was no question asked to the jury regarding liability of TCDC for fraud. And the questions that were asked weren't objected to on those grounds. So why is it, if you're saying it's too late for appellants to bring up their issue about fraud, and I understand that was not part of their motions to dismiss, they didn't make an objection. It was a motion in limine, but it seems like the district court in the hearing, the district court asks, are you asking me to construe this as a motion to dismiss? And then you do have an order saying we deny, the district court is not going to dismiss the fraud claim. So there is an untimely motion for judgment as a matter of law made that includes that argument about fraud that the appellants made. But let's assume that they don't raise it at all until the judgment is a matter of law. And if you're saying that that's too late to raise it as a judgment of matter of law, then why isn't it also not too late? Or why isn't it also too late for respondents to wait until after trial to raise the issue that they did regarding including TCDC?
Well, I think the difference between those two situations is what defense counsel said on the record in open court. She said, there's really no reason anymore to distinguish between the two sets of defendants. And so I relied on that. And therefore we never asked the jury those questions. Then afterwards she comes in and says, well, wait, I do want to make that distinction. And at that point we did not want a new trial. We want defense counsel to be held to her word. So I guess that's one of the differences. I'm not sure if there are other reasons. I'd have to do some thinking about when do you have to make a post-trial motion, but we didn't want a new post-trial. We did not want a new trial. Another thing is that during the trial, the defense did argue that you could make a distinction between his misrepresentations and his treatment. They did that in opening, they did it in closing, they did it throughout the trial. They said to the jury, these are personal problems, they have nothing to do with the care and treatment. But now on appeal, they're saying, well, wait a minute, they were so intertwined, you can't separate them. Well, if the jury could separate them, and if we have to uphold the jury verdict, if it's possible, then I think they're stuck with what the jury decided. Somebody.
Mr. Onsen, in your remaining time, I'd like to talk a little bit about the damages award. Assuming we agree with you that your client was entitled to proceed and have a jury decide her misrepresentation claim, what evidence was produced that would show any economic loss arising out of the misrepresentation?
We had quotations from other dentists about what it would cost to fix this problem, and they were about $30,000.
But as I understand the record, I thought that in fact the work ultimately was done. I mean, I think that Dr. Milan, whatever
it is,
the dentist did a permanent bridge twice, not once, and it was obviously delayed. It happened later on than your client was expecting, but the jury seemed to find overall that the bridge itself, when it was finally completed, met the standard of care. Am I wrong about that?
Yes, that's not correct. She ended up getting a whole new bridge from somebody else. So she spent $8,000. We put the check into evidence. So that's financial loss. And she got estimates that it would cost $22,000 to $30,000. That the bridge that Dr. Smilinich placed was not reusable. So that got removed and thrown away. And then a new dentist built her a whole new bridge and put that in. And that cost around $30,000. So out of pocket, you got $38,000 right there.
So how do we get to the 100,000 jury verdict?
Well, I think due to the exception you mentioned that the general rule is out of pocket, but if that doesn't put people back where they would have been if there had been no fraud, they get
Mr. Onstad, let me interrupt you there because I think there's a difference between the way you're phrasing the law and the exception and the way the appellant's brief phrases that or frames that exception. Is it just economic losses or is it, as you say, returning the person returning the injured party to her previous position?
Well, I think it's the latter, and that's what the jury was instructed, and they did not object to that instruction. So they're stuck with it in this case, whether it's right or wrong. If the jury's instructed about the law, nobody objects, that's the law of the case. And I think
but isn't there also law that says as long as you bring it up in a post-trial, say a new trial motion? I know you're making the distinction between the motion for judgment as a matter of law post-trial and a new trial motion post-trial. But if we don't agree with that distinction and we equate the post-trial motion made by appellants to a new trial motion, isn't the rule that you're saying law of the case that applies only when a party doesn't object and when a party doesn't make the new trial motion? And here we would have that.
No, I think that rule applies if any party fails to object to the instruction. Doesn't matter whether there's a new trial or not. If you say to the jury, okay, here's our questions. We're gonna ask you about fraud. We're gonna ask you about negligence. And if you tell the jury on the fraud, you can include not only economic losses, but disability, all that stuff.
All right, but let me get back to this distinction. And I'll quote you from Wolner v. Mahaska Industries, which is, I think, one of the main cases. It says, quote, in the absence of specific exceptions, the theories of loss submitted to the jury, either prior to the time the jury retires or by post-trial motion for new trial, where the alleged errors are fundamental or controlling the law, as submitted to the jury is the law of the case, cannot be challenged on appeal. It seems to me that those cases allow for a party to fail to object and then make a motion for new trial, and the law of the case would not be as given to the jury.
Well, I think it had the word fundamental in there. It was saying you can't do that unless it's a fundamental error of the law by the judge. And there was no fundamental error. She was absolutely right. There is the general rule of out of pocket, but there is a well-recognized exception. So I don't think that quote is contrary to what I'm saying. I have a minute and a half left. I want to make one other quick point. In their reply brief, they said that words cannot cause physical injury. I don't think that's true. If someone hollers fire in a dark, crowded theater, people can get hurt. Or if somebody says the gun is not loaded or my dog doesn't bite. So I just think they're going too far here, and that the jury verdict should stand because it's one reasonable way to look at this. A jury could look at this and say, those lies, those misrepresentations were separate from his dental treatment. And that's what they did. And the presumption is the verdict is valid. So thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. All right, Ms. McBride, you have the last word. We've got 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Honor. This motion that we brought to post-trial motion was not too late. Rule 50 allows a party to make or renew. It's not federal court. You can make that afterwards. And when a jury's findings are contrary to applicable law, that is what a judgment as a matter of law motion is made for. That is what we brought here. It's appropriate because the verdict was contrary to law. Here, the risk that was not articulated was that he would not be able to complete her treatment, her dental treatment, in a timely manner. The reasons why he couldn't or didn't, or what was going on in his personal life, no, those don't matter. But what matters is that he had a duty to tell her about something that he knew was important to her, and he did not. That is a risk that is inherent in the treatment here. With regard to the economic losses, the fact that that she went on to have a subsequent treatment is neither here nor there. The jury here found that the bridge that he provided her met the standard of care. So there are no damages that arise from the alleged negligent treatment because the jury found there was no negligent treatment. There are no other economic damages here. Fraud cannot cause the things that they are seeking here.
Ms. McBride, I'm going to interject because I want you to answer that same question. The way that you are framing the exception is that it's out-of-pocket losses unless there's some additional economic losses that can be tied, right? The way that it seems the jury was instructed, and as Mr. Olmstead is arguing it, it's the exception isn't just for economic losses. The exception is when the out-of-pocket damages do not restore the injured party to her previous position. So part one, I understand that you made a post-trial motion regarding limiting damages to out-of-pocket. I don't know if you also argued what the scope of the exception is and whether the scope of the exception is economic losses or does not restore the injured party to her position. So part one is, what did you argue about the scope, if anything, about the scope of the exception?
I think you will find that I briefed quite thoroughly. The exception is limited to economic losses. All of the cases that I cite say that. There are no cases cited by respondent to the contrary. And so I think the law is very, very clear on that. And in this case as well, judgment as a matter of law is appropriate because the verdict of $100,000 has no reasonable support in fact and is contrary to law. There is no legally sufficient evidentiary basis that for a reasonable jury to award these damages when there was no evidence of any economic loss.
Except the problem I keep coming back to is that the jury was instructed, in fact, that they could answer special verdict question number 15, which is the damages resulting from the false representation by reference to pain, disability, embarrassment, et cetera. I mean, doesn't that become the law then that governs how, what the jury could do?
Yes, that is, that's exactly, and you articulated it accurately. I would submit that this court can still look at this because the without the objection raised, because the instructions here were an error with respect to fundamental law. The error in telling the jury that they could award damages beyond that which the law allows for fraud destroyed the correctness of the prior fraud damage instruction and is contrary to law. But again, I will remind this court, which I don't need to remind you of, but you don't even need to get to the damages question if the first issue is dispositive, and that is that they could not bring a fraud claim. Quickly, with regard to the TCDC, counsel statement didn't act as a directed verdict. Obviously, counsel respondent thought they had to prove agency because they cross-examined Dr. Gendler. He made closing arguments to the jury, and the jury was instructed on agency. You can't have an agency finding that's all a TCD was, the claim against them was vicarious liability. There has to be a finding of agency. There was none here. There is no basis for holding any TCDC liable. And with that, I ask the court to follow existing precedent and enter judgment as a matter of law in favor of the Smith Lynch defendants and affirm the judgment in favor of TCDC. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to all, both counsel in this case. The matter was well briefed and argued, and it is now submitted to this court for our decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory timeframe.